This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Evelyn McNeil arrived at East Carolina University School of Medicine, she was the first female faculty member the school had ever seen. And unfortunately, you could tell just by looking at her paycheck. She became part of a nationwide effort by the U.S. Department of Labor to achieve equal pay for women, but it didn't start with lawsuits and lab coats. Evelyn grew up in Lee County, North Carolina, during the Great Depression. She worked on a tobacco farm with her family. A career in medicine was nowhere in sight. Evelyn McNeil is now a retired neuroanatomy professor and author of 0 to 80 Over Unpaved Roads, and she joins us now to tell us about her life and work. Evelyn McNeil, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
So you worked at tobacco farm, but that is not the first thing. That's not where your father started out, right? That farm itself was something he created a little later in his career.
Yes, he was a carpenter by trade, and the family actually did the farming under his direction.
How was that? Describe that for us, and what was life like as for a tobacco farmer back in the 30s?
Tobacco farming is one of the dirtiest jobs that there's ever been, according to one of the columnists in Greenville, North Carolina. When you handle tobacco, your hands become black with tar from the tobacco. And customarily, my brothers did the field work. And my sister and I and neighbors and hired Afro-American workers worked at the barn where the tobacco was put on sticks to be hung in the barn and cured in the course of a week to get it dry. My oldest brother took care during the night of stoking the barn, which was a wood furnace. And we enjoyed the work, actually. It was for youngsters to feel that they are contributing to making the livelihood is contributes a lot to self-esteem. So I think because my father was a risk taker and went on a limb to buy a farm on credit in those bad economic times, probably that spilled over on our personalities because three of my brothers have been quite successful, and my sister has been able to, without the help of her husband who left, she's been able to see that all of her children and her grandchildren are getting college educations. So I think farm life and the element of being expected to work very young is wonderful in building character.
Well, those expectations were certainly part of it, but you also say in the book that there was a sense of determination engendered by your neighbor's doubt about your father's success. A lot of people thought he was not going to make it, and I get the sense from you that the family doubled their effort to make sure that their prediction didn't come true.
That's exactly right. It galvanized us to see that what they were predicting wouldn't happen.
Your mother was a teacher, and she actually had to leave that profession in order to work on the farm, right?
Yes.
What did that now? So, but she had a profession, and of course, one of the few that was open to women at the time, teaching, and she had to leave that to work on the farm. What was your? I mean, you were pretty young at the time, but did you have any sense of what that was like, or what that might have meant to her, and how did she feel about sort of having to walk away from a profession to keep the family going?
She never talked about that. What she was doing was more valuable than anything else in the world that she could have done. She was such a wonderful mother and so accepting of all that she had to do. I marvel now at how in the world she fed us breakfast, then worked toward preparing the noon meal, and by about 11 o'clock she could come down to the barn and work in the green tobacco for a bit. But by 11 o'clock she'd go up and have a a good, healthy, nutritious meal for us and for some of the barn help at noontime. So how she did all that is a mystery to me.
Meanwhile, your father, as you said, is a carpenter. Did he come to understand or become a farmer, or did he leave all of that to the family? That was your business.
He had been a farmer, and he knew farming. He had dropped out of school in the sixth grade, and he was from a large family. So he knew how to direct us to do what needed to be done. And so we had a part of our living was from his carpentry pay, and he was quite skilled at that. He built houses in a few weeks with a crew of men. They weren't large houses, but he could do it without blueprints. And he had a great deal of intelligence, and he was a good father.
When did you start having ideas about, for yourself, a career in health?
Not until after I had graduated from UNC. I taught school in Danville, Virginia, in the mill section of town. And it was a junior high school. And the high school students were appreciative of any attention they got. And I loved doing that, but I learned while I was in Virginia what physical therapy is about. And I wanted to go to Duke, but my pocketbook didn't match that. And the Army had a program whereby if you were a college graduate and you had some of the courses that were background for becoming a physical therapist, you got a direct commission. So I became a physical therapist and got paid for doing it. And my part of that bargain was to be committed to at least 2 years. And so it was service for me for education from them.
We will talk more about what you learned in those 2 years and beyond when my conversation with Evelyn McNeil continues. She is a retired neuroanatomy professor and author of 0 to 80 Over Unpaved Roads. You'll hear more about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachowiak, today talking with Evelyn McNeil. She is the first female faculty member of Eastern Carolina University's medical student. Today, Evelyn is a retired neuroanatomy professor and author of 0 to 80 Over Unpaved Roads. And Evelyn, before the break, you were talking about the decision to become a physical therapist, and the Army provided a good way for you to do that. Tell us about your training. You went to Brook Army Medical Center in Texas, right?
Yes, I did. And there were 22 girls from throughout the United States. They were ages 24 to 30. We were all in barracks, and it was a little bit like being in college. And it was a wonderful group of girls. We liked our uniforms. We had some very comfortable shoes, but they were not at all fashionable.
You know, you have pictures in the book.
Yes. Yeah. You agree with that?
I agree completely, yes.
Okay. And we started the day on the quadrangle in formation to take roll call, and we marched a bit on the quadrangle, and eventually marched to our classroom. To start the day, marching to a band is pretty lively. And my classmate, who is from North Carolina, said that I seemed to enjoy it, that she said I acted like a majorette. So I did like that music. We didn't continue to do that. It was orientation to a number of different classes that were on the quadrangle enjoying the music. Our instructors were quite wonderful. And once in a while, one of the instructors would even have nail polish, which was kind of breaking the rules. I don't know why I made a mention that, because we know how disciplined the Army is. And I liked the discipline of the Army. When we were busy in a clinic and there were minutes between patients, we were expected to fold the towels with the blue stripe just right. And it was the discipline of the Army was wonderful to me.
Disciplined and open-minded. Apparently, the Army had no objection or second thoughts about training women to become physical therapists.
Yes, and Truman had integrated the Army before I joined, so it was a real surprise to me when I, in civilian life later, found discrimination because a female captain made the same amount of money a male captain made back in 1954.
What did your family think of your decision to become? I know your father was didn't think this was a good idea, though he was supportive.
He didn't think it was a good idea. My mother supported my doing this, and my dad bought me a trunk to ship my things to San Antonio, and so that made me know he was okay with it.
He was on board at least that much. And in your group, there was one woman from Iowa who was African-American, right?
Yes, only one. And we occasionally left the base to try the restaurants in Texas and would invite her to join us. And we didn't figure it out early on. She always declined. And that, of course, was because she knew she would be refused service. But we liked her a great deal, and we showed our loyalty to her when we had a physical therapy meeting downtown. And it was in, we had to go to second floor where the instruction was being held. And she was told she couldn't ride the elevator. So none of us rode the elevator. We took the stairs with her.
What about you as women as well? How were you treated? And did you sense, I mean, as you say, the pay was equal, but was the treatment always equal for you as women, even in the military?
Yes, I thought it was.
You look back and you talked about realizing when you got into the out of the service and into the private world, there was discrimination against women that you didn't feel as much in the military. You realized that what an African-American woman was feeling that you didn't know about. As you look back over it now, do you see those layers of discrimination and look back on them now and think about it? And I'm even thinking about you working in those barns side by side with African-American farm workers, sort of how you look back over all of that for women and for African-Americans, this kind of these layers of discrimination that were always present but not always visible.
I felt that I was fortunate that my experience as a child working on the farm with African-Americans, I didn't feel the discrimination that many others felt. And I sensed that again when I got in school at Duke. I was in a master's program, but took classes with the medical students. And 10 years after that situation with the Afro-American physical therapy student, Duke admitted its first black student, and he has been very successful. He almost didn't go to Duke because he tried to eat at a restaurant in town that was mad because he wouldn't use the outside window. He wanted to sit in the restaurant like real people. And when he was walking the halls the day he had his interview, what really ticked him to decide he would attend Duke was because he saw restrooms for the black, restrooms for the white, and thought he didn't think he needed to do to, he thought if he could get a degree at Duke, it might move things forward a bit, and indeed it did.
Tell us about your experience in the Army at that base, Brooke Army Medical Center. What kind of patients were you seeing?
At that type hospital, that is usually on a post which is a retirement post. So all ages of patients we saw, and seriously wounded patients who would have to have long-term rehabilitation. I particularly wanted to work in the burn center because of the terrain and the visibility and the climate. There are lots of air bases in Texas, but the Air Force at that time did not have its own burn hospital or burn unit, and we took care of pilots who were burned terribly in planes that went down in flames. We had a big Hubbard tank with ability to put people on a stretcher and submerge them in the water, and the hot and bubbling water sloughed away dead skin, and that made it, it was great for healing, but it was very stressful for a therapist to be working with somebody in such great pain. And by the end of the day, at that particular location in the hospital, I would be walking back to my BOQ, that's Bachelor Officer Quarters, our lingo in the Army. And I would pass by a beautiful white church that had a red carpet, and I would stop and just reflect the day and before I would move on to my barracks. We treated amputees, stroke patients, a wide variety of disabilities. So I thought my training in the Army was marvelous.
Were you expecting that sort of thing? You thought that you wanted to be a physical therapist, but this must be some of the most extreme and the most difficult care that any practitioner is asked to give, is it not?
That's exactly right. And there were, it was sometimes very hard to identify. You thought you were being empathetic, but you can't really know how somebody feels who has been burned extensively and doesn't know what life is going to hold for them. But I loved being a physical therapist. The only reason I moved on to get a PhD was because I enjoyed my work so much in getting a master's degree at Duke, and found out after a rather hard start that if I could pass the courses that the medical students were taking, that I could get a PhD. So with my mentor's blessing and with another scholarship from the American Physical Therapy Association, I enrolled for a PhD at Medical College in Virginia. And the reason the American Physical Therapy Association was making scholarships available, because the Second World War brought physical therapy forward, and we had a number of women that were very smart relative to promoting physical therapy. And so if it was great to have a scholarship because I could put my entire efforts to studying. And I loved studying to the extent that I would study 14 to 16 hours a day. And I was an overachiever.
Evelyn, it's been less than an hour, and in that time you've told me that you loved working with tobacco and getting tar all over your hands, and you love studying 14 hours a day. I just want to tell you that's the first time that's ever happened on this show, that somebody said they loved all of that quite so much. So.
Okay.
But you did more work before you went to school. You did spend some time in Durham working at what was then Watts Hospital here, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that experience.
I was lucky to get that job, and the reason is that Dr. Everett Bug, an orthopedic surgeon who had graduated from Duke, was my superior. He was in charge of the physical therapy department, and I admired him so much. I name him as one of the platonic loves of my life, and he was a no-nonsense guy. On ward rounds one day, he was admonishing a young man to work harder at getting more motion in his hand. And the patient said, "Dr. Bug, Rome wasn't built in a day." And Dr. Bug said, "I wasn't in charge of that project."
I see. But still, you went on. You went to school, and you got your PhD. And tell us about that and the subject that you chose and why you chose that area.
I chose neuroanatomy because as a physical therapist, I would get one patient that had had a stroke, and the stroke may involve the left arm and left leg, and then another person may have a stroke and had just the arm involved, and that made me want to understand more about the brain was organized. I had had neuroanatomy in physical therapy school, but not to the extent that I wanted to know it. So that's why I continued. I just was so enthralled with the brain. And one factor that drove me in that direction was when I was in Kansas, an OBGYN person made it possible for me to see a child born. And that was such a moment for me that I became even more engrossed in not just neuroanatomy, but embryology and all of the anatomy that I would get both at Duke and at Medical College of Virginia.
You know, we're hearing even today the difficulty in engaging women in the sciences and graduating them at the upper levels and postgraduate level. What was it like for you as a woman in the sciences and neuroanatomy back then?
It was the first class at the beginning, the struggling school to become a four-year school at ECU. We had 20 students, and one girl was in the class, so that was 5%. By the time I retired in 2001, consistently the classes were about 50% women. And the women were not discriminated as students in the School of Medicine. I was discriminated against pay-wise, and I loved 26 of the years that I taught, but there were 4 years that were very painful for me because after working teaching neuroanatomy to physical therapy, occupational therapy students, as well as to the medical students, and I was not only was I the only woman, I was the only neuroanatomist, so that was a double teaching load. And I was not getting raises like a man who was hired at the same time I was hired. We were hired at the same price or at the same amount of money. By the time 5 years had passed, he had been promoted and continued to get raises. And I had not been tenured. I didn't get promoted. And somebody on the campus, a woman, I think, in the French department, took a survey and announced to the labor department in Washington that there were people being discriminated against. And so that was really the whistleblowing.
We will take a break now and come back and hear more about that part of the story as my conversation with Evelyn McNeil continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Evelyn McNeil, first female faculty member at Eastern Carolina University School of Medicine, today a retired neuroanatomy professor and author of Zero to 80 Over Unpaved Roads. And some of the bumps along the way were your experience at the med school, where you were hired on equal terms but noticed that the men were getting ever more pay raises, where they were getting tenure, you weren't. What was the first thing you did when you brought this to the school's attention? How did you first do that?
I first talked to my chairman, the Department of Anatomy, and the next step was to speak to the dean. And finally, results were not forthcoming with those visits, I went to see the chancellor. The chancellor treated me like a child, kind of patted me on the head, and dismissed me. I then contacted an attorney, a woman, and she was from a reputable firm in was it in Durham or Raleigh? But at any rate, once she took my case, they started paying attention. But they set out to hire a man to pay him $10,000 more than I was being paid. And there were no complaints about my performance. That was not an issue. So once the attorney got on the scene, eventually I got promoted, my pay raised, back pay. So I was happy with what they did regarding my pay. However, they did not, they hired the man and put me in charge of undergraduate teaching and took the medical neuroscience course, which was my path to full professorship in time, and put him in charge of the course. I didn't want to make a lawsuit because I loved my job, and I loved the school, and I didn't think it would be worth it. It took 22 months of letters back and forth to resolve my problem. And so, fate was with me. The man moved on, and, the chairman had to teach the course himself for a couple of years, and he gave the course back to me. So it was the 4 years involved there that I considered I was like in Siberia. But once I got the course back that I loved doing, so fate did me well.
Fate, but not the legal system necessarily. Give us an idea. When was this now? What year was this?
This was 78 and 79.
So, in effect, they were going to say, if we had to pay you equally, we'll just move you, we'll demote you, and we'll put a man in that position. If we had to pay you for the position, we'll take you out of it.
Right.
And you get the back pay for having served in that position.
Oh, I brought that on myself, I'm afraid. I had a Rosa Parks moment when I was told they couldn't raise my pay, and so I said, well, if you can't compensate me for what I'm doing, maybe you can reduce my responsibility. That was not wise on my part.
So they figured that out. Eventually they came around, but almost by default. Now, was the Labor Department any part of this, or just the fact that you had an attorney ready to go?
No. The Labor Department had to pass on this. Mm-hmm. So the Labor Department men's names are carbon copied to many of the letters that my attorney wrote. So the Labor Department was monitoring what was going on with me.
Now, have things changed systemically? Because obviously, as you say, it was a kind of an accident of fate that you got your job back. How are things today for women in terms of pay, in terms of treatment, and in terms of tenure track and all the rest?
Much better, but it's still a problem. In fact, I have talked with the present dean of the school about this, and he says it is an ongoing problem. And we know that today women make 77 cents to the dollar that men make. I was in the book club meeting with the first woman who was chairman of a department, and she learned this was after the dean had moved on. The deans had changed, but she learned that her pay as a chairwoman department, was less than that of men. So she asked to see the dean, and he was quite surprised. She said to him, I'm the only faculty member that is published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and why is my salary not like that of the men's? And he was totally caught off guard, but he remedied it right away.
Why do you think it's so slow to change? As you said, now about half of the med students are women these days. We've seen plenty of it. There have been lawsuits. So from every angle, both in terms of our experience, we know we've certainly seen plenty of evidence that women are more than capable of doing these things equally. There have been lawsuits. Why is it so slow to change?
I think it's just habit. We like things the way they are. I mean, the men have been in charge, and they like being in charge, and that just is hard to change.
You tell us about your decision to write this memoir now. You did this, began writing it in 2005, 0 to 80 over unpaved roads.
I wanted to make the story to my nieces that they really can make a life if it's not their fate to fall in love and have children, that your life is what you make it, and that I've had a very happy life and probably was better as a teacher than I would have been as a mother. I don't think I had the strength to do all that my mother did. Teaching seemed easy compared to that. My nieces, I haven't gotten a book to each of them, but even the one that was born this year while I was writing the memoir will get a copy, so that 50 years from now she'll have a copy to know that your life is what you make it.
You talked about all these expectations that we face and that sometimes become a burden to us. Men want to stay in charge. You know, if you have a privilege because of your race or because of your gender, very hard to let go of that. You grew up and worked against many of the stereotypes and the challenges and expectations. You went into the health field. You got a PhD in neuroanatomy. You did not become a homemaker. Everybody expected that this is what you would do. Were these difficult decisions for you? Was it hard for you to walk against the grain through all these experiences and people you love and a community that you felt very close to?
Yes, because all my life people had asked why I'd never married. And I didn't really know, but after I wrote this memoir, I had figured it out.
So you didn't know that going in. The memoir actually helped clarify all this for you.
It did. It did, because there was never a given point in my life that I said, I want to be a professional woman. I just loved my work so much that I continued with more schooling, and I also had some reproductive issues that meant I would not be able to have a family. And so I figured that I must look after myself, and that's when I decided for sure I would get a PhD.
In the process of making those decisions, did you find yourself struggling with what other people might say? Worried about what people would make of your decisions?
No, I didn't. I didn't. My co-writer, who is Mark Rutledge, put it in words I hadn't thought of, and it was I had made a road plan, and I didn't want anybody else to plan my trip. And that's kind of how it evolved.
Even though it was over unpaved roads, which you helped pave.
Well, yes, I did.
You structured this memoir around letters to your father, sometimes letters that you've written, but mostly letters that you imagine. Why? What was the point of that?
My father had a serious drinking problem, and that was more prominent in my life when it was happening. And looking back on it now, I realize that 90% of my father was an outstanding man, and his problem, which I consider genetic, with alcohol doesn't have the importance to me anymore. And one of my brothers asked me why I was writing letters to Dad when our mother was such the stable person in our family. But she lived to be 94, and he died at a young age. So through the letters, I came to appreciate all that he did for us. He showed his love for us through his work and providing for us. And I'm in a Rotary Club that is purpose of the Rotary Club, the big purpose, is to eradicate polio. And if they choose another project, I hope it would be the tragedy that alcoholism is.
What is it that you're hoping that your nieces and other women get from your memoir?
That never mind if people ask them why they aren't married. Just be pleased with your choice and make your life the best you can.
Evelyn, thank you so much for sharing yours with us. Evelyn McNeil, a retired neuroanatomy professor and author of Zero to 80 Over Unpaved Roads. You can find out more by going to our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Our intern is Bryson Russell. Robin Copley is our technical director, and Brent Wolf is our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.